This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists. What do scientists talk about these days when we give them a mic and let them speak freely? Find out on Got Science, the podcast from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We hope you are enjoying the fruits of your labor today. A day of rest, though, is probably called for in Washington after the emotional send-off for Senator John McCain this past weekend, and ahead of the hearings set to start tomorrow for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We want to spend some time there today. Kavanaugh is a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., but also served in the George W. Bush White House. On Friday, word came that more than 100,000 pages of records from that period will not be released, the Trump administration saying they are covered by executive privilege. Meanwhile, Democrats are calling out the person in charge of culling those documents, Bill Burke, a friend of Kavanaugh, who also represents a number of former White House officials as their lawyer. That includes former White House counsel Don McGahn in the special probe from special counsel Robert Mueller. Democrats say that makes Burke compromised. They say he can't be trusted to choose the Kavanaugh documents. Let's dig into this with Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, also a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, no rest for a Supreme Court scholar today. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, there's so much to talk about. Again, we want to spend a few minutes here. Would you agree, though, first of all, that this is one of those somewhat rare transformative appointments? Kavanaugh, a conservative who would replace a more moderate Anthony Kennedy.
Yes, it is a transformative moment for the Supreme Court. Anthony Kennedy was, on many cases, a reliable conservative vote, but there were really important ways in which he broke that mold. On gay marriage, for example, he was the author of the decision that legalized gay marriage throughout the country. He sustained access to abortion, and he narrowed the death penalty. So in these really important areas of law that a lot of people pay attention to and care about, Kennedy did not toe the conservative line, and there's no reason to think that Kavanaugh would take Kennedy's position in cases like that.
Well, there's every reason to think he won't. We'll get into that. But it's also been pointed out by Adam Liptak, your peer in the New York Times, that Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts were on the opposite sides of 51 closely divided decisions in which Kennedy, as you said, joined with the court's liberals. In addition to rulings going forward, which are at stake in this nomination, are those past rulings also at stake?
Absolutely, because the Supreme Court has the power to change its mind. It's not something the court does lightly, but it happens in all kinds of areas of law. And so when you see those 51 decisions and you imagine them being revisited in a new case, then you imagine them coming out differently. Mm-hmm. Abortion, presidential power, affirmative action. There is a long list of rulings in which we can expect Kavanaugh to take a different position from Kennedy and thus change the law.
And interestingly, Justice Roberts now becomes the swing vote, which is so interesting. He was seen as such a conservative. But on each side of the court, there are staunch liberals, stauncher conservatives. So Roberts would be the swing vote.
Yes. And that is a sea change of itself. I mean, one way to think about this is that really since the 1950s, there have been members of the Supreme Court who were appointed by one party and drifted in the other direction. Mostly Republican appointees drifted left or served as swing voters. And I think it's fair to say that our whole modern conception of the Supreme Court as a nonpartisan body that does something called law that is different from politics depended on these figures and their kind of outsized role on the court. And we are coming to the end of that era.
Yeah. Sandra Day O'Connor, one who was one of those in the past appointed by Reagan and drifted.
Absolutely.
But take up some of the news from the weekend going into these hearings. These 100,000 documents the White House is withholding. Democrats say the documents they can see have been cherry picked. There's something like 400,000 that have been released. Republicans say the documents left out are irrelevant. Talk a little bit of how interesting this is, because, again, this nominee, you know, this is also rare that you have a nominee who worked in the White House.
Right. So Judge Kavanaugh was the staff secretary to George W. Bush during the Bush presidency. And the Trump White House is asserting executive privilege for, you know, I think a couple hundred thousand documents that Kavanaugh, that passed through Kavanaugh's hands. And so the potential window that we could have had into Kavanaugh's work and into some of the inner workings of the Bush White House is gone. We don't know what lies behind that curtain. And because Republicans are in control of the Senate and the confirmation process, as well as the White House, we are not going to find out.
And people from the Obama administration have been quick to point out to the Washington Post, for instance, that when this same situation occurred for President Obama and his then nominee, Elena Kagan, they did not claim privilege and did not withhold documents.
Right. And so we have this question about openness and transparency. If you have a Supreme Court nominee whose record is part of the executive branch, who worked, you know, in the White House, or in Elena Kagan's case, she was a solicitor general, how much are you going to let the nomination process shine a light into those internal workings of government? The Obama administration had a different answer than the one we are seeing now from the Trump administration.
Let's look at what we might hear about this week. A couple words are going to come up. Originalism is one. Some of Kavanaugh's supporters have been framing him as an originalist, someone interpreting the original meaning of the Constitution. You have an opinion piece coming out later today saying that's not accurate. How so?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh himself has been sort of cautious about claiming the originalist label. He's used much more general ways of talking about his own philosophy. He's talked about history, tradition, judicial restraint, deference to the legislature, competing for primacy of place in interpreting the law. And that's fine, but it's not originalism, because pure originalists believe that you go back to the original meaning of the Constitution when it was written, and that's how you interpret it. Mm-hmm. And originalism has been very useful to conservative judges in claiming that they have this neutral way of interpreting the law. So in a sense, it's surprising to see Kavanaugh back away from it.
Well, but he does call himself a textualist. This has also been applied to Alito, Gorsuch, Chief Justice Roberts. What's that?
Well, that just means that you're reading the text of the law. And, you know, there's a kind of common sense element to this, right? If you're a judge, then, of course, you would start by reading the words of the statute. In fact, all judges do that. So textualism, you know, if it's very wooden, it can lead to results in which legislatures end up having less power, because if they say something ambiguous, then the courts will kind of pull back. But it's not necessarily a conservative or a liberal outcome. And in fact, Justice Kagan has quipped that we're all textualist now. So textualism doesn't really do the same work of separating conservative jurists from liberal ones.
Yeah. He's going to be asked about presidential power. Given his background, he worked under independent counsel Ken Starr while Starr was investigating the Clinton-Lewinsky affair. At that time, Kavanaugh pushed for harsh questions for Clinton with explicit sexual details. That memo came out. He, though, didn't recommend criminal prosecution of Clinton while in office. In 2009, Kavanaugh wrote an article in the Minnesota Law Review saying that a president should not be criminally prosecuted while in office. So what might questions be? What answers are you looking for about presidential powers?
Well, the senators will ask him why he's had this change of heart. He, as, you know, a lawyer for Ken Starr, was gung-ho about going after President Clinton. But then, as you said, he wrote a law review article in which he said it's debatable whether presidents can be indicted. And in that article, he really sort of put it on Congress to resolve that issue. But Congress has not really resolved it at all. And so then the question will become for the senators, what would you do as a justice? But I think we can expect Kavanaugh to do his best to try to duck that question. That's sort of a classic mode that we've seen from Supreme Court nominees in the last few decades.
And Democrats are pushing for Kavanaugh to recuse himself in any cases involving President Trump. And, you know, there's an ongoing investigation. What are the case they're making? What's the case they're making?
Well, you know, Democrats are saying a president who could be indicted is now in a position to choose the person who could have the deciding vote on that matter. There's something wrong with that picture. But Judge Kavanaugh is not going to agree to recuse himself before he gets to the court. He doesn't need to do that to win confirmation votes, since Republicans control the Senate. And also, Supreme Court justices control the rules for their own recusals. There is no higher body that says, like, oh, no, you really do have to recuse yourself. So this choice will be up to him.
Yeah. Roe v. Wade. Kavanaugh told Maine Senator Susan Collins that she supports abortion rights. And he said that Roe v. Wade was settled law. But a lot of people are looking for different language there. What is that?
Well, settled law is all well and good until it becomes unsettled. The Supreme Court very much has the power to overturn Roe versus Wade. And so to say that something currently is settled law is not to say that it will remain thus in the future.
Because a question would be, do you think it was decided fairly? Is that the language? Is that the
Right. Do you think it was decided correctly? Mm-hmm. Would you uphold it if you were on the bench? And I think, again, we will see Kavanaugh sidestep that question when, in reality, what we know from his record suggests that he would certainly erode access to abortion, if not overturn Roe outright, right away.
Boy, Emily, I have so many other questions, but we've run out of time. I can't believe we gave you extra time, too. But this is
the
kind of week it's going to be because there's so much to talk about. Just quickly, 30 seconds. Does it matter? A lot of people say this just doesn't matter. It's going to happen. It's done deal.
It matters a great deal for the shape of American law.
But,
and
I mean,
that
do the hearings matter?
Hearings don't matter.
Hearings don't matter. Well, wait, we're going to devote so much time to them this week. Emily,
outcome doesn't matter. The process is important for informing all of us, right?
But we pretty much know what's going to happen. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there went our whole week. It doesn't matter.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a biweekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
Out in paperback this week, an acclaimed novel that took a Greek tragedy and gave it devastating new life. The tragedy, Sophocles' Antigone, tells the story of Antigone and her sister Ismene. They can't save their two brothers. Both are killed in war. One, the soldier, is buried with honors. It's decreed that the other, the rebel, the embarrassment, must be left on the battlefield to rot. But Antigone defies that decree, buries him, and faces the inevitable consequences. Author Camilla Shamsi transformed that story into her 2017 novel, Home Fire. At the center, two British-Pakistani sisters, Isma and Anika. Isma raised Anika and their brother Parvez in London after their parents, including a father they hardly knew, die. Isma goes off to study in the U.S. Anika studies law in London, and Parvez becomes fodder for ISIS recruiters. Homefire won the 2018 Women's Prize for Fiction and was longlisted for Britain's Man Booker Prize in 2017. Dwight Garner of the New York Times said of the book, "It builds to one of the most memorable final scenes I've read in a novel this century." We agree, and we will not give that ending away. Author Camilla Shamsi was born in Pakistan, became a British citizen, and just like her character Isma, studied in the U.S. We spoke when Home Fire was published last summer and began by asking her what she was trying to say with this nexus of London, Pakistan, and a U.S. university.
It's not so much I'm trying to say as I'm trying to explore and understand. Mm. You know, and these are places which have interrelated histories within my life very personally, but also in the last few years, I suppose, within sort of a post-9/11 world, there have just been different ways in which all three countries have been caught up with the war on terror and have different ideas about it. And if you're someone who moves between the three, you get very struck by the way people see the world differently and experience being in the world differently. And I was also interested in what it is to be a Muslim in Britain, which is my new country. I mean, I became a citizen there 4 years ago. I've been living there 10 years. So in a way, I think this was me exploring this new nation that I'm now a part of.
Yeah, and I'm looking at you. You're wearing a beautiful dress. Your arms exposed. You're not wearing a head covering. Mm-hmm. Isma, your character, this older, sober sister who's raised her siblings, she does wear a head covering. Mm. And the book starts, and it's half comic. It is actually the comic tragic, masks, because the interrogation that she goes through, leaving Britain and then coming to the U.S., it lasts nearly 2 hours. Officials want to know her thoughts on Shias, homosexuals, the Queen, democracy, the Great British Bake Off, the invasion of Iraq, Israel, suicide bombers, and dating websites. Mm-hmm. And she had prepared for this. Is this something you're familiar with? Muslims traveling in the world, training with friends for what they might be asked?
I've never had anything as grueling as Isma's had. But when I go through security, and now I've got a British passport, it's less. But when I had a Pakistani passport, there was always this sort of way in which I was preparing myself. And I did. I mean, I never prepared for questions on the Great British Bake Off, though I know people do get asked things that are ridiculous.
They want to detect if you really are a British citizen or if you've somehow faked your papers.
Yeah. It's sort of unclear what it is, because people do. I mean, you know, there are British Muslims who quite clearly have the passport, and it's almost as if they're trying to trip you up somehow, get you agitated. It's completely unclear to me what the questioning is about.
Well, listen, if somebody asked me about the Great British Bake Off.
Yeah.
I don't think I've only watched it once or twice.
So, well, I did. I mean, the last time I came, I thought, what if someone pulls me aside in the American interrogation room and say, so what do you think of our president? You know, you do have these questions. You think, what will I say then?
Well, and as you write, Muslims prepare. They did try to come up with the right answer. Mm-hmm. And when Isma finally gets to school, we meet another character, Eamon, who is the son of a British official. Tell us more about him and what he means in the story.
He's British like her. His father is from a Pakistani background like her, but they couldn't be more different. His father is a very powerful politician. He's the Home Secretary, which would put him as one of the senior most figures in government. And his father's from a Muslim background, but has really, in some ways, made a political choice to disown the Muslim side of him in order to progress politically. And so Eamon, the son, whose mother is Irish-American, he sort of grows up without any sense of himself as being of a Pakistani or Muslim background. He's just a very privileged British boy who's used to every kind of privilege and doesn't think about this aspect of his own heritage. And then he runs into Isma.
Well, Isma and her siblings do have to think about it, because another part of the backstory is that the father that they hardly knew was a fighter for Muslim causes, from Bosnia to Chechnya to perhaps Guantanamo. I mean, there's a backstory that they don't know that much about. And that brings us to Parvez, the brother who, when the sisters fly off, he is preyed upon by ISIS. He's recruited. And part of it is he desperately wants to know who this father was. I mean, there are so many threads here. Do you know these people? Were you imagining these people? What would it be like if your father was at Guantanamo? Where did it all come from?
It was a fair amount of imagining and some sort of extrapolating from situations that might be more familiar. But I suppose I've spent a number of years thinking about young British Muslims and what it is for someone a generation younger than me who's really grown up Muslim in the post 9/11 world and who feel themselves within a country always being an object of suspicion. You know, and that's true of those whose fathers didn't have this life. But in this case, I overlaid on it the fact that this particular family, there's an extra level that's internalized because they know that their father really was this terrorist to some, freedom fighter to another.
And you seem to put those fears in the mouths of a cousin. We've said Parvez does get recruited by ISIS, the brother. And at one point, Anika, his twin, is desperate, just like Antigone, to help her brother. And she appeals to this cousin in Pakistan, and he says, crazy girl, I don't want to know anything. Did you stop to think about those of us with passports that look like toilet paper to the rest of the world, who spend our whole lives being so careful we don't give anyone a reason to reject our visa applications? Don't stand next to this guy. Don't follow that guy on Twitter. Don't download that Noam Chomsky book. And then he goes on to say, here's what your brother did. By joining ISIS, he jeopardized everyone that ever knew him.
Yeah, it's the whole guilt by association thing, right? I mean, if you're a Muslim and some cousin or relative of yours or someone with the same last name has done something, you have to live with that. You know, if you're a Muslim committing a crime in the world, you're never the lone wolf. Everyone in any kind of contact with you is viewed with suspicion. And the cousin that is talking at this point isn't just Muslim, but he's Pakistani. He's got a Pakistani passport. He has to go through incredibly rigorous visa checks to come to America, where his sister lives. And he's saying, you know, this distant cousin who I never knew has gone and done something, and now that jeopardized my ability and my parents' ability to go to the country where my sister, their daughter, lives.
So many characters, so many story threads that all come, you know, knit together. But we want to mention, you know, this is modern day. In Sophocles' time, in Greek mythology, there was the Greek chorus. You know, the people watching on the sidelines, maybe giving some insight, describing events or narrating or talking to the characters. You have media and social media.
Yeah, I had some fun with that. Because you know, when I was reading the play, of course, the Greek chorus plays a huge part. And one of the things you notice is they're quite fickle. And one moment they're siding with the king and the other moment they're saying, oh, but Antigone is looking so sad. And, you know, I'm sort of feeling for her right now. And as I was reading it, I thought, oh, this could be Twitter, you know. And I wanted to work in that sense of the wider world. So although it is about two families, it's also about the country they're in and the mood of the country. And I wanted to get that through via the tabloid press, via Twitter, via news reports and all kinds of things. And you know, because that is the chorus with which we're living in.
Antigone does not end well for Antigone.
No, that's the nature of Greek tragedy.
And yeah, I was glad that I didn't go remind myself that. And I would say to listeners, read your book first and then go back to Antigone. But your ending is just stunning. We don't want to give it away, but it is breathtaking, breathtakingly sad. Why end it on that note? Because you could have just jiggered it a little. I mean, it's Antigone, so you kind of, but you could have just jiggered it a little bit.
So here's the thing. When you write a novel, you come to get very deeply invested in the lives of your characters.
Same when you read it.
I'm telling you, it's more if you're living with them for months and months. And so as I'm approaching the ending, I lie to myself about what that ending is because I can't bear what the ending actually is. So I tell myself that I am going to actually fudge it in a little way or make something else happen. But there's a sort of inexorable logic to the novel you're writing. It's moving in a certain direction. And at a certain point, there is only one end point that makes sense. I like to believe that even within the ending there is something that is human in a way that is optimistic. But to give the sort of, but really it's going to be all right, folks, ending is just false, you know. And there are too many moments where that we're living in and around us where we know that it's a lie to say that. And what we have to say is, look, this is the direction in which we're heading. Look at it. Just look at it. And then go away and think about that and see what you want to do about it.
Kamala Shamsi, the novel is Home Fire, a novel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Author Kamala Shamsi, we spoke in 2017. Home Fire comes out in paperback tomorrow. And with college football underway, focus is turning to action on the field as opposed to this summer when the spotlight was on off-field scandals, including at Ohio State, which suspended coach Urban Meyer for the first three games because he mishandled domestic abuse allegations against assistant coach Zach Smith, who's since been fired. John Bacon is well known for his books on college football. He joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And John, you could be writing a new one with these new scandals. Start with Ohio State. In your opinion, should Urban Meyer have been fired?
It's not quite clear because evidence is still coming out from the investigation, so it's hard to make that call right now. With all the shades of gray in this case, though, one of them that is not a shade of gray, of course, is domestic violence. He knew about this and did not act appropriately, and that is clearly going to be following him the rest of his career. So, also, by the way, his apology was so bad, delivered like a hostage, basically reading a statement, that he had apologized for his apology. So that was mishandled from the start.
What's the shade of gray?
The shade of gray is how much is an employer responsible for an employee's actions in a private setting. It's not Title IX because Courtney Smith, Zach Smith's wife, is not an athlete, is not a student. So, and also ADA gets thrown into this, believe it or not, Americans with Disabilities Act, because he's an alcoholic. And now the claim is you can't fire him because he's an alcoholic. So all kinds of crazy things are involved in this case that are not normally involved in this case.
Just to be clear, the assistant coach is the alcoholic.
Correct. Yeah. Not Urban Meyer, and he's not accused of any abuse whatsoever.
Yeah, but of not maybe doing something about it sooner. So there's that story. Then you have Maryland's coach, DJ Durkin, on administrative leave after 19-year-old player Jordan McNair, this is just so sad, collapsed during practice, died a few days later. You just a hard practice. University President Wallace Lowe said the school accepts legal and moral responsibility for Jordan McNair's death. There was also that explosive ESPN report that documented this toxic environment around the Maryland football program. So your thoughts there?
This is by far the saddest. Well, they're all sad cases, clearly, but this is as sad as it gets. It seems to be an overbearing strength coach, and again, the toxic environment you describe, where these players are basically bullied into doing far more than any humans should be doing on a hot day on a football field. What I find galling about all these situations is you've got the coach on the one hand saying one day how close their teams are like families, and the next day they don't know anything about anything going on.
Well, we've seen with concussions, like at the high school level, that there were changes made. Kids can't play after a concussion. You know, there's all sorts of rules. Will this at least maybe institute some rules about heat and how tough you can be on players?
There already are rules in place that were not in place 20 years ago about the limits on practice time, what you can do, what you can't do. Those have clearly fallen short of this situation. So I would imagine they'll have more rules down the road and should, and the sooner the better. We can't wait for this.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, the Jerry Sandusky scandal at Penn State did not take that football program down. It took many of the men involved down. You just talked a little about how changes might be instituted, but there's so much money involved in college football. Is there a sense that, you know, some of these people involved, you know, maybe they shouldn't be fired, but maybe they can't be fired because there's too much money in the programs?
Urban Meyer has won one national title at Ohio State and two at Florida. They are very reluctant to fire Urban Meyer. If he was 5-7, I think he'd be gone. So too big to fail, too successful to fail is also a factor here.
Yeah. John Bacon there in Ann Arbor, Michigan. His latest book, by the way, The Best of Bacon, Select Cuts. Oh, that's so clever.
Thank you.
Collection of his sports writing. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Golfer Jack Nicklaus won his last major at the age of 46. Baseball Hall of Fame pitchers Nolan Ryan and Randy Johnson both retired at the age of 46. But our next story is about an athlete who, at the age of 46, was just getting started. Karen Given from NPR's Only a Game has more.
Pat Gallant-Charette woke up early, around 3:30. She ate a bagel and tried to stay calm as her son Tom wrote two names on her left upper arm, Robbie at the top and Johnny below.
You know, I told Tom, I said, whoever would have thought it would have come to this point?
Pat and Tom made their way down to the docks, where a boat took them to Shakespeare Beach, just south of Dover, England. At 5 minutes to 5, on June 17th, 2017, Pat began.
When I took the first few steps into the ocean, I was stunned to see how cold it was. Right off, I didn't think I was going to make it. But I wasn't about to throw a towel in after an hour.
The water got a bit warmer after the sun came up, but halfway to France,
the oil tankers were going by and they were churning up colder water. And a few times it felt like it was 50, 52 degrees.
Still, Pat thought, I can't give up now. I've come so far. So she kept swimming. And then
I saw this large dorsal fin not too far from my feet. And I said, my heavens, they don't have sharks out here.
Pat figured she must be hallucinating. She kept swimming. While Pat swam, Tom counted her strokes, tracked her food intake, and watched for signs of hypothermia.
It's like watching paint dry. To go on to 17 hours of watching someone slowly swim across the English Channel, you know, it's... But he never took a break. He stood there at the side of the boat the whole time and watched, just to make sure that everything was going fine.
Pat Gallant-Charette is closing in on a world record.
That's Tom providing commentary from the boat. With a successful crossing, 66-year-old Pat Gallant-Charette would become the oldest woman to swim the English Channel.
She's about a mile from the France shore. Stay tuned.
To have my son there, it was a wonderful feeling because years ago, he was the one that, you know, really started this.
To really understand why Pat keeps swimming, we have to go back, not to the story of Pat's son, Tom, but to her brothers, Johnny and Robbie. Pat grew up in Westbrook, Maine, with six brothers and a sister. She says her family has always been very close.
Johnny was like an all-American. He was 17. He was an altar boy, paper boy. He was an incredible runner. He had broken the state record in track. and he was in his junior year of high school, and he was doing a physics experiment, and he was accidentally electrocuted in class.
I've never heard of such a horrifying thing.
Yeah, yeah. I saw him that morning because I was going off to nursing school. I was 21 at the time, and he was going to deliver newspapers before he went to school. And we both waved to each other and smiled, and that was the last time I saw him alive. He was the first one that we lost, and, you know, it was horrible.
Pat's brother, Robbie, was the youngest of the bunch. He swam at Northeastern University. After college, in the early 80s, he won a 2.4-mile open water swim called the Peaks to Portland. Pat says she was stunned. Robbie won the race a second time, and then in 1997, when he was 34.
I got a phone call, and they said that Robbie had a heart attack. So we went into Maine Medical Center, and I remember saying to my son, Tom, I said, now listen, we've got to be very positive, and we got to tell him that he can go through cardiac rehab, and he's going to be fine. And as soon as I got off the elevator, I knew immediately something horrible had happened, and found out that he passed. And it was absolutely heartbreaking.
Days after Robbie died, Pat picked Tom up from swim practice. He was 16 at the time. In the car ride on the way home, he told her that he'd like to swim the Peaks to Portland as a tribute to his uncle.
And I said to him, that's so sweet. I wish I could do the same.
In that moment, Pat had no doubt. Swimming 2.4 miles in open ocean water was not something she was capable of doing. Sure, she'd been on the swim team in high school, but
we were never even taught how to do a flip turn.
Pat got married at the age of 21. She had kids, got her nursing degree. She says life was very busy.
You know, you have laundry to do and shopping, and all of a sudden 30 years goes by. And I'm thinking, oh, wow.
When her brother Robbie died, Pat was 46 years old. Her idea of exercise was walking around the block. But there was something about this idea, the chance to honor her brother by swimming that race. Pat and Tom kept talking about it for the rest of the short drive home.
And he goes, well, you know, you can if you try.
And here's the crazy thing. When Tom said, you can if you try, Pat believed him.
Yes, I did. You know, I said, well, why not? I'll give it a try.
But 3 decades after her last competitive swim, Pat had a lot of self-doubt. That first day, she asked lifeguards to keep an eye on her to make sure she didn't drown. It took Pat a year just to qualify for the Peaks to Portland. And that self-doubt, it still hadn't gone away.
Even the day of the Peaks, I remember thinking, what did I get myself into? You know, look at that distance. I remember standing on Peaks Island with all the other athletes, and here they were younger, slender. It was like, oh, Pat, you know, I thought I made a mistake. But then I just, you know, I calmed myself down and I said, you know, Pat, you're just here to swim as a tribute. Just do this once and that's it. But something happened that day. As I started to swim across Casco Bay, I just saw the beauty of swimming in the ocean and to see lobster boats going by and seeing the seagulls squawking. I just fell in love with the sport. When I crossed that finish line, I felt like an Olympian. When I was training and I was able to swim, you know, 15 minutes nonstop, I felt like an Olympian. The first time I was able to swim 1 hour nonstop freestyle, I got out of that pool as though I had won the gold medal. You know, I was just so proud that I was able to do that. And now here it is all these years later. You know, I can swim, you know, these incredible distances.
After Pat turned 50, she noticed that her endurance was actually increasing. She realized she could swim 4 miles and then 10.
And I noticed that after I'd finished these swims, I didn't feel tired. And I told my husband that. I said, my heavens, I said, I know I can go much further. And he goes, well, why don't you try the English Channel?
Hey, good job. Thank you. Awesome.
Last June, despite cold water, oil tankers, and an ocean sunfish with a dorsal fin that looked a lot like a shark's, Pat completed her second successful English Channel swim, becoming the oldest woman to do so. It took her 17 hours and 55 minutes.
My son was there to greet me at the ladder. You know, we both hugged, and I had tears in my eyes, and it was just, it was very special.
But Pat has set her sights on an even bigger challenge, swimming the Ocean 7, a collection of the world's most difficult open water crossings. Since the challenge was established in 2008, fewer than a dozen people have completed it. Over the past decade, Pat has traveled the world, setting 6 world records along the way. Until recently, all of her swims were funded with money she earned working as a nurse.
For many years, I worked Thanksgiving, Christmas, for that extra money, because I didn't have any sponsors.
Pat says she's had many unsuccessful attempts, swims derailed by currents and eddies, swims made miserable by frigid waters and jellyfish stings. But none of that really bothers her. It's not about getting to the finish line. Pat Gallant-Charette needs just one more swim to complete the Ocean 7, the Cook Strait in New Zealand. She attempted it 4 years ago, but was unable to finish.
But I'll be going back next year, and I'm hoping that I'll be successful. But if not, you know, such is life, you know, you just go on to something else.
For Here and Now, I'm Karen Given.
So where are we on a new NAFTA, a North American free trade deal? Yesterday, Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, said a new deal won't work if it's just the U.S. and Mexico. Canada has to be in it because the three countries' economies are so entwined. The president slammed him for that in a tweet today. And on Saturday, during Senator McCain's funeral, Trump tweeted that there's no political necessity to keep Canada in the new NAFTA deal, and Congress should not interfere with these negotiations, or I will simply terminate NAFTA entirely. Well, against that backdrop, Canadian and U.S. trade negotiators meet again on Wednesday. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us every Monday from New York. Derek, happy Labor Day.
Hey, happy Labor Day.
Thanks for laboring with us. And boy, in that sort of roundup of the backdrop, we didn't even include the president's comments last week to Bloomberg News. He said a deal to add Canada to the deal he's already struck with Mexico would be a deal totally on U.S. terms. He said he couldn't talk about it on the record because it was going to be so insulting to the Canadians they wouldn't make the deal. Now, these were off-the-record comments, but they were leaked by the Toronto Star. But that can't be helping negotiations.
No, it cannot. This has been an absolute mess, and it's been a mess for the entirety of Trump's presidency. He has threatened over and over again to tear up NAFTA, and for now, NAFTA remains. But just a quick bit of background, I think, is important. So NAFTA was enacted in 1994, and the idea was to eliminate most of the tariffs and products that were traded between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, mostly in cars and farming. It's not just Trump, though, who is against NAFTA or who thinks it's been bad for the U.S. There's a lot of people on the left, too, who think that NAFTA has been a bad deal for the American worker, particularly in the automobile manufacturing industry. And the way that I see it is that NAFTA has clearly hurt some American jobs, but it's also reduced prices for all Americans, and it's added a lot of jobs in Mexico. And I think you could argue that that is a win for the world, in fact. And it behooves the United States to say, all right, we've got a trade deal that's reducing prices on goods for Americans. Let's find targeted policies to help the handful of American workers who are being hurt by this deal. But rather than do that, we're thinking of it as a zero-sum trade problem. We're trying to stick it to Canada and Mexico, and that is, I think, where the president has lost his way.
When you say, by the way, it's added jobs in Mexico, you mean for Mexicans, and I think, and that's ultimately good because if more Mexicans have jobs in Mexico, it helps reduce the problem of people crossing the border.
Absolutely. Oh, there's so many different ways you can think about it. On the one hand, you could say it's great for the U.S. because it means that fewer people are going to cross the border. And indeed, what have we seen in the last 10 years? Reduced
immigration from Mexico. Immigration from Mexico, you wouldn't know this from listening to the president, is way, way down from where it was 15 years ago as the Mexican economy got stronger. But also, I think that, you know, the U.S. foreign policy cares about the welfare of people who live outside the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's why that we have, you know, foreign aid. And, you know, free trade is a marvelous form of foreign aid. So I think there are many ways in which free trade is a really good deal for the world, provided that the U.S. be smart about protecting people right here in the U.S. who might be hurt by free trade. So I think the president just has this totally wrong.
Well, when you say help the people, for instance, would those be the dairy farmers along the border? That's one of the biggest complaints about the NAFTA deal, that there's a huge, huge tariff from Canada on dairy products going across the border.
That's right. Yes, there are still tariffs. And it's important, I think, for us to work with people in Canada and Mexico to bring those down, because ultimately, I think free trade is a good thing, provided that you have domestic protections against it. Right now, however, what the president's trying to do is unilaterally withdraw from this without a debate in Congress, without a formal debate, happening in the U.S. He's trying to unilaterally withdraw. And I'm not sure that this is about dairy farming for him. You know, this is not a president who thinks institutionally, not a president who tends to think strategically. He often acts with personal grievance. And I think in many ways, he is upset with comments that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has made about this White House, and he is therefore trying to punish Canada.
Well, in the minute or so that we have, what can he do? I mean, he tweeted over the weekend, Congress shouldn't interfere, or I'll just end it. What legally can happen here?
This is a really difficult question. So technically, under NAFTA rules, Trump can unilaterally withdraw. I think the big thing here, though, to repeat, is that we have been through this. At least we've been through these threats. In October 2017, Trump threatened to pull out of NAFTA. We had a big to-do about what exactly that would mean, whether he could do it unilaterally, how Congress might respond, and then what happened? That didn't particularly go anywhere. So it's possible that this is just a bit more bluster, even though the president has clearly leaned in to a trade war policy with other countries. I think it'll be very, very interesting to see if we have, in the few months leading up to the 2018 midterms, a serious effort by the president to tear apart NAFTA in a way that violates many of the interests of the Republican Party at the very time that party sees itself as being threatened in the midterms. I think this is going to become not just a question of international trade, but also a question of domestic politics.
We will see. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And some deadlines to watch. If President Trump decides to leave NAFTA, he has to give Mexico and Canada 6 months' notice, which would push this past the midterms. And as of now, the president has 27 days to get the final text of a new NAFTA deal to Congress. So mark your calendars. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.